This episode of Recovery Rocks is sponsored by SoberLink. And Lisa and I know that it's not just recovery that rocks, but waking up clear-headed rocks, remembering what you did the night before rocks, and so does establishing healthy relationships and accountability with the people that you love.
And we know that can be hard. SoberLink's remote alcohol monitoring system is designed to help you reclaim stability in your life and sustain a sober lifestyle. It's trusted by thousands of treatment professionals nationwide.
Click the link in our show notes to learn more about SoberLink and get $50 off your device. Shout out to SoberLink.
Welcome, everybody. It is Lisa. And as always, I'm here with the most amazing co-host a co-host could have.
Wow, what an intro. It's Tawny. I love you so much, Lisa.
What's up? And we are very excited today because we are joined by an incredibly special guest. Ann Dassett Johnston is with us, and I'm so excited. We both are so excited. And I know a lot of you know, but just in case you don't, Ann is the best-selling author of Drink, The Intimate Relationship Between Women and Alcohol, the book that broke the story on the pinking of alcohol marketing and the closing of the risky gender gap. Now a psychotherapist, Ann runs her popular memoir writing course called Writing Your Recovery, Open to Women. And we're going to talk about that and share all those links. And Ann is located in Canada, but the light of her life is here in California, her granddaughter, Frankie. So, Ann, welcome to Recovery Rocks.
Thank you so much, and so great to be with you, Lisa. We're very good friends, and to meet you, Tawny.
Yes, when Lisa told me that you wanted to come on the podcast, I was like, I had to read it twice. I was like, really? Ann wants to come on our podcast? This is so exciting. We're so happy to have you here, Ann. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is really fun.
Tawny sent me all the exclamation points when I texted her. And Ann, I have to say, Ann is a dear friend who I have been fortunate enough to know for years now. And Drink came out, I believe, in 2013, right?
That's right. That's right.
And talk about a groundbreaking book. I can't even describe because I, as I've talked about before on the podcast, one of the things that started me writing was that I was ripping all these memoirs off the shelf. You know, I got sober in 2004 and I couldn't find anybody who had my story, who wrote like, where's the book about the woman who succeeds in business? And, you know, it doesn't necessarily all end up in a gutter and, you know, but goes through this experience. And Drink came out and, you know, I can't even tell you how it changed the game because Ann is a, you know, really accomplished journalist. And Drink brought, it was the first story of this kind to bring in research, like journalistic research and a journalistic eye to the specific issue of women and alcohol. And within it is Ann, is woven Ann's personal story, which is just so, was so relatable to me. And I felt just like, I remember just nodding my head through the whole thing. I would, when I was reading it, I had it in hardcover and I couldn't wait to get home and keep going and keep going until it was done. I read it so fast because I just gobbled it up and it made me feel not alone. That's really what the book did. It opened this huge, you know, this huge pathway where I could see like, oh my gosh, we, not just like there are women who get me, but also like this woman is a badass and she's out to make a state. She's making a clear research statement about women and the particular risk to women and how women are targeted by marketers of alcohol in particular. And so anyway, that is, Ann is, when we talk about icons on Recovery Rocks, Ann is an icon.
Well, that's what I was going to say real quick before we hear from Ann is like, you know, I got sober in 2015 and this, we didn't have the term quitlet back then, but you know, now quitlet is like the hot new thing, which is, you know, literature about quitting drinking. And this was really like the, Lisa, your book was 2016?
My book was 2016.
And hers was 13. Yeah. So it's like, you know, drink was like a pre-Quitlet, you know, like it really set the tone for the Quitlet era that we're in now. You know, like I think it was such a trailblazing piece of work. And so thank you for paving the way for us.
Well, thank you so much, Maya. I'm blushing here. The story was definitely mine from the time I was a little girl. This is the sad story was that my beautiful, beautiful mother was cross-addicted to alcohol and benzos, Valium, as so many people were in the 60s. And I had been thinking about this for a long, long time and fooling myself that I wasn't indeed an alcoholic because I didn't look like my mother. I didn't stay home. I had a big job. I won awards at work. I never drank during the day. All sorts of reasons why I could not have an alcohol problem like my mother. And indeed I did. And I hid for the first little while thinking it's just me. And then I realized that the New York Times started talking about it. And I thought, no, I'm not alone. And the rest is history, as we know.
Yeah.
So many of us. And of course, the pinking of the market was what I was really focused on. And the fact that big alcohol had really targeted a whole gender because they realized the Johnny Walker drinkers were dying out in the 1990s. And they had to do market segmentation and think, how do we save our bacon? And it was to go after women.
Yeah. It is really insidious.
And, so insidious.
You know, and how do you feel about it now? I feel like there's so much more. Ever since I think you kind of blew the whistle on that fact, it's become this, by articulating it in your book, it became this thing that other people could also look to and say, here's an example of that. Here's an example of what Anne talks about. Here's an example. And we still see it. But I feel like there is some, you know, that what you set off in talking about it has led to some real, you know, awareness of it in a way that it gets called out. And, you know, I feel like, and this is just like in what I see around me, I feel like it's improving some, but I'm cautious to say that. Do you think it is?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair given the awareness now and given the, you know, although like you, I live part-time in California and I'm still shocked at the little handbags that are really alcohol holders or little lipstick containers that, you know, I'm still shocked at that. What has really changed, as we all know, is the boom in non-alcoholic beverages. That is really a big story now. But it remains insidious, as you call it, an insidious truth that this gender was targeted, and it is so different on a health basis for women to drink versus men in terms of hormonally and metabolically. It's not body size. We are just built differently than men are. And so that was a big part of what I was looking at in my book, too, was just how at risk we are.
That really opened my eyes because I always kind of knew, you know, women, not me because I had a wooden leg, but a lot of women would get drunk easier. And they're just watching women go shot for shot with, you know, guys who are twice their size or 50, 60, 70 pounds heavier than they are, thinking that can't be impacting these two people the same way. And just, but I had never, you know, it was just sort of a gut thing when you see women get drunk quicker or whatever. But then when really in reading your book, that's when it was like, wow, this is like the hormonal stuff I wouldn't have known about, like just the very specific information. You want to talk a little bit more about a woman versus a man in terms of somebody who's drinking a lot?
Yeah, we, you know, it was really fascinating to do the scientific research and realize that, you know, men and women will get hemorrhagic strokes, but women X amount faster. And we actually do become addicted far more quickly than men. Telescoping is real, as it's known. And realizing, you know, I think in my book, so there are those who said, well, we just learned about breast cancer and alcohol, but that's not true. My book, as you say, was 2013, and I broke that news in the book that 15% of breast cancer cases are related to alcohol consumption, and yet at the time, only under 5% of North American women knew that. And so I think we're very slow to make the link that it's a carcinogen and that it's much more dangerous than we ever knew. And Canada came out with really pioneering low-risk drinking guidelines in January of this year. And they were presented at the WHO last week. And they are extremely stern that no alcohol is good for you. And that if you wanting to look at low risk, you're looking at under three drinks a week, really got the Canadian public upset.
See, this is the thing, right? It gets people upset because they don't want it to be real.
Well, they don't want to change their daily habits and stop and think, you know, like that's what is so appealing about alcohol is that it kind of prevents you from having to think and deal with reality. So when these kind of statistics come out, it could be jarring.
Exactly. That's exactly the truth. And so I think that if we have a better public dialogue about this, but it really was, let's plug our ears and not hear this news. So that was very telling. I did about, 100 interviews and people were saying, how will this land? And I said, very poorly.
Yeah.
And it did land.
But yes,
very,
you
very
did
poorly. Right.
But
you did it.
Yeah, you pressed on, you know.
Yeah, and she persisted. Nevertheless, she persisted.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of my work is really examining the relationship that people have with alcohol and dating and relationships and intimacy. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on that, you know, whether it's people needing, you know, I talk to a lot of people who quote unquote think they need to have a drink to feel more confident on a date. Women, and a lot of women, including myself, used alcohol to feel more confident in bed, dealing with body image issues and, you know, and things like that. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that, that part.
Oh, I think you're so right. As a person who's single herself, I think there's a chapter in my book called Romancing the Glass, and it's all about the correlation between romance and alcohol. And I think that, you know, it's liquid courage, as we all know, whether it's walking into a party and a social lubricant or whether it is literally a lubricant for making love to somebody. I think it's very, very complex to face singlehood. And I think a lot of women confront it when they're sober. I applaud you for addressing this because I think it's the thing that many people think but don't talk about.
Well, and you know, the reason, like yourself, the reason as a journalist I was drawn to this subject and this intersection is because it's something I struggled with. Was like, you know, when I was debating on giving up alcohol, I was like, yeah, but how the hell am I going to go on a date? You know, how am I going to be in a relationship? How am I going to do this stuff without alcohol? And so, you know, my work is also, it's journalistic as well as personal experience, but which is why I love your book so much, because I think it is such a perfect balance of journalistic research, science, statistics, interviews, and also your story weaved throughout. And it's, you know, and on that intersection of alcohol and sex and dating, there's also, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up how, you know, 75% of sexual assault is taken place when one or both people are under the influence.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's something that I have done a lot of speaking on campuses, and, you know, men and women, young men and women play drinking games, and she's 2/3 the size. And as Lisa was talking about, you know, she's probably for calorie reasons drinking vodka or tequila. He's drinking beer. She probably didn't eat before she went out. He probably did. And thus we have the problem. Thus we have the problem, which is that, you know, it's a date rape drug. It often is.
That's exactly it. The date rape drug is like, when I learned that, you know, the number one date rape drug is alcohol, that blew my mind, because I always thought of, you know, roofies, Rohypnol. But what are people usually putting roofies in? It's alcohol.
Right. And so I think it's a big part of the story. There's a chapter in my book on the campus culture, and I think it is a very big deal. And you're right. We're remiss not to talk about it.
What are your thoughts on the sober/sober curious world now? You know, it's 10 years since Drink came out, and, you know, we didn't have the word sober curious back then. And yeah, I'm curious on your thoughts on Quitlet and sober curious and the thriving non-alcoholic drink movement. So much has evolved since your book came out.
The world has exploded, hasn't it? It just is. You couldn't have. When I got sober, in Toronto, there are 500 AA meetings a week. So lots of choice, but you did walk down the basement stairs of a church usually and drank bad coffee, and that was your alternative. And now there's just what I call almost the Walmartification of sobriety, where you can do it at every level. You can pay a sober coach an exorbitant amount of money. You can get sober in any different way that you want, and you have a library to choose from. You have non-alcoholic beverages, really, really a wild number of choices there. So the whole world has changed, but fundamentally, has the world changed? I was at a recent event in Palm Springs, Sober in the City, and there was a mixologist, but I don't buy it. I don't think the world is changing around alcohol. Not really. Not in a profound way. I think we still live in an alcogenic, alcocentric culture. I think the pressure to drink is still large. I still think it's the one drug that you have to explain to people why you're not drinking, and nobody asks you about anything else. And I still think it's complex to decide not to drink. I think it's in fact, very hard. I met a young woman yesterday in her 30s who hasn't had a drink for 2 years for no really big reason. She just decided for health reasons and told me how hard dating is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah, we have nothing to say. It's like, yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I mean, I think it's, you know, even for friends who do apps and all of that, you know, when they meet somebody, they're very clear on the dating apps that they don't drink. But a lot of them have, you know, gotten into date situations and things like that, where it was like, well, that's not really, you don't really not drink, right? Like you don't, you know, and it shouldn't be hard. It's not like, you know, you're posting like, hey, I'm in recovery because I had an addiction to alcohol. You're just saying I don't drink. And so, for it to be this thing that is so taken for granted that when someone actually has articulated, I don't do it, and you still doubt it when you go out with them and you think that's going to change, you know, it's just so ingrained. I was with my niece and nephew a couple weeks ago in New Jersey, and she's going to be a junior in college. She's going to be a freshman in college. And I was like, I've been reading these things about Gen Z not drinking as much as other generations. And they both looked at me and they were like, that's not true. You know, my my nephew, Ben, who's going to college in the high school, like, he doesn't even, you know, he's not even a drinker. But he was like, oh, no, they're walking around with these half-gallon jugs and, you know, that's like the, whatever they're doing now. And he was like, no, it's that bad. And, you know, you think about, actually, I was saying how I thought that maybe it had been getting a little better in terms of targeting women, but I had not even thought about the whole fact now of like rosé in a can and, you know, they took our seltzer and made it hard everywhere, right? Even that. So yeah, it is still just such the pervasive assumption.
Totally. And I think that I've been on campuses where they've said, I will present the research and present the health implications, et cetera, and over be told, you got to do it. I get to do it. It's my time. And don't tell me.
Oh, wow. Like it's a privilege. Exactly. Welcome to my misery.
Yeah. Welcome to my misery. Exactly. It's funny.
Yeah. So tell us now that we're talking about writing and, you know, obviously all three of us write, but you are teaching. I mean, if I was, you know, if I was going to take this class from anyone, I would be taking it from you. And you do this workshop called Writing Your Recovery. And I know a lot of our listeners, you know, maybe write for themselves or journal or do things like that. Some are, you know, trying to write a book or whatever it is. Tell us about writing your recovery and what it, you know, how it's for kind of both the person who's, you know, thinking about writing a book and the person who's just writing to help them cathartically and to process and all of that. But how, what writing your recovery can mean.
Okay. I imagined the kind of course that I would have liked to have taken had I not written Drink. What didn't I know? How did I want to be drawn out? And I didn't know how you got an agent. I didn't know how you got a publisher. I didn't know how you began the process of writing a book. So I created a course, 8 classes, 2 hours each, with me on it, basically walking people with prompts, etc., through the process of how you take this dream of writing a book to writing a book. And I think we've had roughly 100 plus women through the program in the last several years. And once you, if you really are bitten with the bug, we then go on to writing your discovery, which means you go into a pod with some of the people you graduated with. And one woman has already completed 2 books, has an agent. It's essentially on the foundational belief that I have that putting the microphone up to my lips and writing my book was the best thing I ever did. That I grew up in that era of secrecy where you never talked about drinking and drinking problems and, in fact, owning it. So it's recovery of any sort. I have people with eating disorders, with drinking issues, with a lot with grief, a lot with guilt and shame. And so you get a in fact, I just finished a class half an hour ago and vibrant, connected women. And it's a little bit like a support group as well. So lots of friendships form, lots of tenderness, people all over the world from North America to Europe, the UK. It's lots of fun. We have a great time.
I love the support group aspect. As the three of us know, writing a book is one of the hardest things you can do. And you need support. You need accountability. You need peers. Like it really is similar to recovery where you can't do it alone. You really can't. You need people, you need guidance.
Yeah, you need that kind of community. And I think I learned from the sobriety community that I had that community is what kept me sober, kept me on the right path. And women are so good at this. Women are exceptional at this, of supporting one another. And you're right, Tawny, it's such a lonely thing to write a book. And they give each other You know, as you mentioned, I went back to school to become a psychotherapist in my 60s. And my agent said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm bringing that support group temperature, environment into the writing community. And it really works. It really works. People this morning were going through marriage breakups, going through death, and not only reading each other's writing and listening to it, but really feeling it, but supporting each other as well.
I think
that's
it's
so huge.
Also really beautiful that you went back to school in your 60s. I mean, I don't want to gloss over that. Like, I think we need to like really honor that, because so many people, even like I'm 37 and I have friends that think about going back to school are like, it's too late. Like, what's the point? And it's not, it's like I, Lisa knows I'm such a nerd. I love learning. Like, I'm basically in a
lifetime learner.
I'm in a DIY master's program. I'm always taking some class. But my mom's 57, and she just graduated from college. She went back to get, she's now a substance abuse counselor.
Wow.
And I think it's so cool. You know, she started the program at 55, graduated at 57. And, I think we need to hear more stories like this where people are, you know, starting a new act, you know, like we need to talk about that more.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of books about, you know, going to school, being in a couple, raising children, your career, and then we get to a certain age and it's, you know, do you play golf and do you play bridge and you die. And I just think there are so many other options. And so I watched my son cross the stage. He became a psychotherapist after years of being an artist, and I watched him and thought, it's not too late. I can do it. So I think it's probably a little weird for him. I followed in his footsteps.
So are you like, do you meet with clients or is this more? Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yes. Yes. I have a full client base roster. And then on top of that, I do writing your recovery, writing your discovery. So it's a busy life, but it's the way I like it. And jam full, like too many cherries in the Christmas cake is the way I like life. And it's busy.
And I feel like what you're saying, all of these things that led you to where you are now were like the next logical step from where you were, right? Like, it took you to the point where it was like, okay, now it's time to go get my degree and become a psychotherapist. Like, it wouldn't have been what you wanted to do 30 years ago.
No.
Or even necessarily 10 years ago. And, you know, these things just... it's like being open to what shows up next in sobriety. It can be so surprising what it is, you know, like I was 50 when my book came out. And then a couple of years later, we started this podcast. Like, I never would have imagined anything like that. But if you keep showing up for what you care about and what brings meaning to your life, we always talk on here about service and how much helping the next person helps us, right? And I think of, you know, being a therapist is like massive service. And it's doing, you know, it's still following. Yeah, you'd rather be doing this in a day than playing bridge. Because that's where it makes us feel full and keeps our hearts full and our heads full. And that's kind of what's behind what we do. But you could never, it's more to that point of like, couldn't map this stuff out if you tried.
You know, no, you
10
couldn't.
Years ago, you never would have mapped out the three of us sitting here this morning today, doing what we're doing and talking about what we're talking about.
No, you're absolutely right. I always say the universe has a better imagination than I do.
Yes. I love that.
And that's what this is about. And you know, just like you with your book, Lisa, a lot of people have heard your story and a lot of people were reaching out to me and I realized it could help more people if I was a therapist. So it is service. You're right. It is
service. And I remember us talking about that. Yeah, we did. No, it's so fantastic. And I just think for anybody really who is, you know, thinking about writing their story, all of our stories are important. And yeah, take this class. This workshop is the one to go to if I were going to be going to a workshop to do it. There's no question. I mean, as you can hear, we don't have enough praise to shower on Anne because, you know, she really has set the tone for so much of what we do now.
Thank you. Thank you. You two are amazing. Well, so, I have fun.
Anne, let's chat about music. If you're down, you know, you're on Recovery Rocks. So we always ask our guest about the role that music plays or played in your recovery.
Well, my son would roll his eyes. My 39-year-old son would roll his eyes at this one. I got sober to Van the Man. Van Morrison.
Oh, nice.
Van Morrison was my guy. And I went to Dublin, saw him in person. I've seen him in North America, and he's generally been horrible. But I saw him with all his people and his relatives on stage with 14 people in Dublin, and he was extraordinary. And so I got sober round the clock to Van Morrison, and probably, corny as it is, Bright Side of the Road.
Oh, I love that. That's awesome. Mm-hmm.
That is
a great anthem.
Yeah. That or Did You Get Healed? And I'm really a big fan. So my son would say, "You have not moved on, Mom," and I say, "That's just fine."
I have to say, there's a Van Morrison song that I think about in terms of two things. In terms of one, being mindful, being present where you are, and then also two, going towards the idea that we talk about on here sometimes, that happiness isn't having what you want, it's wanting what you have. And that song is Cleaning Windows.
Oh, I love Cleaning Windows.
Right? It's a great song. And it just very much makes it like, hey, I'm good here. This is what I do. It's my thing. I'm not comparing. I'm not whatever. And I love that. Van Morrison's a great choice. Underrepresented on Recovery Rocks, I have to say.
Well, is that right?
You know, I'm being quiet here because I have some Van Morrison PTSD. My ex was obsessed with Van Morrison, and so it's like it's one of those like I listened to Van Morrison with him all the time, and so it's not something that I. Like I usually change, like if Van Morrison comes on, I usually change it because it brings up. But like I really want to get over that because I know I'm missing out on so much. So I think I'm gonna start. Anne, what should I start with? will you diagnose me, or will you prescribe me with a Van Morrison song?
Yeah, well, you have to love Jackie Wilson said. You have to. I mean, if you don't love Jackie Wilson said, then you know that just from the opening bars, you're gonna love it. But
yeah, and I think, you know it.
I have to believe
it's in the background. Yeah,
I'm afraid you might know too much. You've been overexposed.
Well, but it's been a very long time. It's been. Oh my gosh, now that I think about it, it might have been when your book came out that I was with this person. So I think enough has changed.
That's funny.
Enough has shifted. I can get back into it. So I will start with that and Cleaning Windows. That sounds interesting.
Yeah,
so.
And Yeah, and do Bright Side of the Road, because that's just one of those. Sometimes we talk about the songs that are just sort of a happy song, period. Like, okay. You can always put it on, it's a happy song. And Bright Side of the Road is that song.
That love kind it. Of
song, I think.
Yeah.
Great. Connie's got homework.
I have homework. Like I said, I'm forever a student, so I love it. I will take this on.
Yeah.
That's terrific. I will just tell you quickly, I got sober because my beloved cousin was killed by a drunk driver, and that was the end. And we played Bright Side of the Road at his funeral to lift the mood. And it's worth it. It's a happy song.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I'm excited to re-expose my ears to Van Morrison.
Right.
I mean, perfect. Lisa knows my first and biggest love of my life is Jim Morrison. He's been my almost like my North Star. It's very strange how
it's not an obsession. It's a different kind of vibe.
Yeah, like it's a whole other thing, but so I'm always like, when I hear Van Morrison, I'm like, but I should just listen to Jim Morrison. I have a lot that I need to work through, clearly. Maybe I should book a session with Anne and she can help me unpack all this.
You need some help here.
Yeah, like I need very specific Van Morrison therapy.
All right. I like it.
And we cannot thank you enough for coming on and joining us. This is just such a treat and such a delight. And really, everybody, read Drink, take the workshop. We're going to have all the links and all the socials. You can check out Anne everywhere. And we hope you come back. We'll talk about this stuff again.
That was so much fun. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Anne. Talk to you soon.
Talk soon. Okay. Bye-bye.
Hi, everybody.
Thanks for listening. We hope you like what you heard. If so, please hit subscribe and consider rating and reviewing us so others can find us. Tawny, how can our listeners find you?
You can find me at Tawny M. Lara on all of the social medias. And you can find my blog, sobrietyparty.com. Lisa, how can we find you and your amazing book?
My book is Girl Walks Out of a Bar, and it is available at bookstores everywhere and online. And you can find me at lisasmithadvisory.com. And I'm on social media at Girl Walks Out. Thanks for listening.